Oh my God.
Woo!
Hello and welcome to A Century in Cinema. My name is Arthur, local filmmaker here in Utah, and I am Daniel Day-Lewis at the end of There Will Be Blood, just sitting on the bowling alley floor, yelling, I'm finished!
And I'm Andrew, professional film historian, lying dead at the end of a bowling alley.
You're Paul Dano in this situation?
I'm Paul Dano. I'm both Paul Danos.
This is a podcast where we watch and discuss a classic film that I have not seen.
But I most likely have.
From every year. This week, we're in 2019. We're watching A Hidden Life, directed by Terrence Malick. For any new listeners, you can find where our movies are streaming or available to rent online down in the link in our show notes. And it is our last year that we are doing For A Century in Cinema. We started in 1920, promised ourselves we'd do 100 of these films, a whole century of films, and here we are, 2019. There is no 2020 episode. There is no 2020 episode.
Yeah, where are you going with that? Trying to disappoint them?
But I think for our Patreon episode, we could talk about what we would have talked about in a 2020 episode. Ooh. Does that sound like something we could do?
Yeah, that sounds great.
We are going to keep our Patreon active. You can still access the whole library of Patreon episodes. And I mean, if you were smart, you would just pay for a month, listen to all of them real quick, and then cancel. But you know what? That is okay. You are still helping to support the show, and we thank you for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because podcasting, not the cheapest side gig on the planet.
Definitely not, and absolutely not the most lucrative.
Now, where am I going with that? I don't know where I'm going with that.
Have we mentioned in the episode proper that you have COVID and like brain rot is occurring while we're recording? Is this your first time having it?
It is, yeah.
Well, you made it further than me, so I'm pretty mad about that. But you still got it. But yeah, the brain fog is real. And it's crazy when you're recording one of these episodes. He only has to record one. I had to record two during that time period. So my sympathy is limited, but I do have sympathy.
Thank you for your sympathy, Andrew. Let's continue with our show, though. This is the last official episode with a big movie discussion. And if you've been enjoying A Century in Cinema and you still haven't given the show a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, well, what are you doing?
Right. What are you doing?
You should go do that. And maybe you're asking, why? The show's over. But just because the show's over doesn't mean you can't help A Century in Cinema. In the analytics, we can get some new listeners out there, bring some joy to the world, and just think you, dear listener, can be a part of that joy.
Absolutely. This was always intended to be a completed project that people could reference and go back to. So even though this is the end of it coming out weekly, this is the beginning of it existing as intended.
Yeah, it's not like other film review podcasts or other podcasts out there that only deal with the current events. I mean, this is a podcast about the past century. It's always going to be out there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, ratings and reviews just make Andrew and I feel good.
It makes us feel really good.
We just need to be told we did a good job.
We are desperate for some validation out here, people.
Okay.
Oh, man.
If you've been listening, you know what's coming up next. We always like to give a little bit of context for what's going on in the year that we're talking about. We're in the year 2019.
The last good year. Oh, just kidding. This one's going okay.
And I'm going to mention some of the big events, according to Wikipedia, just to jog your memory. But you're probably going to remember other important things that happened in 2019. Or I'm just going to overlook a bunch of super important stuff. You know, yada, yada, yada.
Yada, 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 yada.
Now, Andrew, according to the New York Times, and I have no idea how they came up with this, 2019 is, quote unquote, the best year in human history. Do you have any thoughts on that?
What's their basis?
I clicked on the link, but my number of free articles is run out, oh. So I don't know.
This is a disaster. Let me see if I have a free article available. This has been the best year ever. Oh, Jesus. This is so bleak in retrospect. December 28th, 2019. For humanity overall, life just keeps getting better. In the long arc of human history, 2019 has been the best year ever. 2019 was probably the year in which children were least likely to die, adults were least likely to be illiterate, and people were least likely to suffer excruciating and disfiguring diseases. 325,000 people got their first access to electricity every day. 200,000 more people got piped water for the first time every day. 650,000 people went online for the first time every day. If you were given the opportunity to choose the time you were born in, it'd be pretty risky to choose a time in any of the thousands of generations in the past. Almost everyone lived in poverty, hunger was widespread, and famines were common. But President Trump, climate change, war in Yemen, risk of nuclear war, all of those are important concerns, and that's why I write about them regularly.
Easy to forget that around the world, a ton of people still live in extreme poverty, and it's important to help lift those people out of it. Yeah, COVID brain fog, man.
Yeah, I mean, this is your section, man. I don't have any way of helping you. I don't even know what you normally do for this part.
It's okay. I'm just going to read what I wrote earlier. There are massive protests and riots in Hong Kong pushing back against Chinese authoritarianism. Andrew, you'll remember Hong Kong, formerly a British colony, is now in a slow transition to become part of China again. And the final assimilation is scheduled for 2046. There are also huge protests in Chile due to rising social inequality. And there are also huge protests in Iraq, sort of for the same reason, social inequality, but also pushing against U.S. interventionism. And in the U.S., the House of Representatives votes to impeach President Donald Trump for the first time. There are also huge protests in Venezuela this year. I kind of remember 2020 as the year of mass protests, mainly due to the pandemic.
And police racism, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, maybe that's just my perspective from here in America, because when you think of the protests going on in 2020, do you think those would have happened if not for the pandemic? Kind of like everyone just being cooped up at home and being like really anxious and all of this. Like, I always feel like the summer of 2020, those protests happened because of the pandemic, but maybe they didn't. Maybe that's just my perspective. But yeah, revisiting the events of 2019, there was a lot of unrest around the world, a lot of people pushing back against social inequality in countries all over the place. And yeah, this is the time that we're living in. But yes, speaking of the pandemic and the quarantine, the first human case of COVID-19 is identified in Wuhan, China in December, which obviously becomes important a little later, causing a worldwide pandemic, shutting down the usual way of life in 2020, forcing many people to stay home, and inspiring some people to buy recording equipment and start up podcasts.
Kind of like this one.
Boom! Here we are. Talk about movies.
Talk about movies. You know, it's funny you mentioned that New York Times article, because I remember in 2019, this was the year I was working in Salt Lake Film Society. I was just, in general, I really did have a phenomenal year in 2019. I was feeling great. And I remember going to the movies so much this year and seeing so many great movies. And I was like, man, 2019 is one of the best years in movies in recent memory. I wonder how 2020 could possibly top it. Those were words that I said frequently during this year. And it's just funny to remember that in retrospect. Because, yeah, 2020 was a rough year for everybody. Cinema was not excluded from that.
But what's your guess for what's at the top of the box office, number one in 2019? Worldwide box office numbers, that's what we're looking at.
Worldwide. Because I feel like Joker was pretty high. Spider-Man
There's a movie that's just so obviously there at the top.
Avengers Endgame, is that what came out?
Avengers Endgame, $2.7 billion worldwide.
Temporarily unseated Avatar, but Avatar did a re-release exclusively in China and made $600 million and took back its spot.
Just make a quick $600 million over in China. Crazy. You have any guess what's at number two at the box office?
Well, I'm guessing it isn't Joker. And it is it Star Wars?
No, you're not going to believe it, but Star Wars is all the way down at number seven.
No, I believe it. Is it Spider-Man?
No, but that's at number four. You're getting closer.
I'm getting closer. Surely not Toy Story 4.
No, that's at number eight, actually. You're way far away now.
I feel like... Oh, wait, Frozen 2?
Oh, that's number three. You're very close. Ooh, he's getting warmer.
It's a Disney.
It's one of your favorite live action Disneys.
Oh, no.
It's a live action Disney that's not actually live action.
I haven't seen that movie. But yes, okay, The Lion King. Oh, my God. Yeah, it made over $1 billion.
Almost everything on the top 10 made over $1 billion.
That's insane.
Everything down to number nine, Aladdin, made over $1 billion. Also, almost everything on the top 10 this year belongs to one company, Disney. You got Avengers Endgame, you got The Lion King, you got Frozen 2, you got Spider-Man, you got Captain Marvel. Now, Joker, obviously not part of Disney, but then there's Star Wars, Toy Story 4, Aladdin, and then at number 10, you got Jumanji, The Next Level. That is not Disney.
So scary.
Yes, that is scary. I have nothing to add.
This is the world we're still living in right now.
I've heard from filmmakers that even though there's a consolidation of media, you know, that's not great. Monopolization like this is not great. It still sounds like there are more, I hate this, but like content producers out there than ever before. There's just so many other people trying to make stuff out there. And, you know, there's one company, Disney is doing extremely well. There's one company that's dominating. But there's still a ton of other people who are trying to get into the game and trying to make movies, trying to make TV. And it sounds like filmmakers are pretty happy with the current environment. Now, that might monopolies don't we'll see what the future holds.
Didn't Disney take over Fox this year?
Yeah.
So keep a pin in that, audience. We're going to be coming back to that later. But that was a net negative, I think.
Not great.
Well, my first recommendation for the year has to be Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker.
An obscure Star Wars.
This was, yeah, an underseen Star Wars film.
No one I know actually saw this.
And I did. Yeah, I shouldn't have. I shouldn't have gone. Yeah, I almost made like a joke top like five recommendations where I did Star Wars and then I didn't really finish the bit, but I was going to end, of course, with Tom Hooper's Cats, which I did see twice in theaters. I feel like there's no other place in the episode to discuss Cats. So we're going to do it now. Have you seen this?
No.
It's a perfect COVID brain fog movie.
It's a perfect COVID
brain fog movie. Perfect COVID brain fog movie. Yeah, Cats was a disaster. One of the most fun times I've had at the movies in recent memories was seeing it opening day. As soon as the movie started, I mean, our entire group was just out. We were just like, oh my God, this is even worse than we could have imagined. And then as the film continued, we were like laughing and joking. And there was this older group of people behind us, like they looked like they were in their 60s, 70s, and they were two rows behind us. And at first they were making sort of loud, annoyed sounds. But about halfway through the movie, they really gave up and sort of started laughing with us. And then three rows ahead of us at the very front was this family and these two little kids. And maybe 15 minutes into the movie, the young boy in the family got up and just ran out of the movie theater. And the mom went after him. And I almost completely forgot that even happened. 30 minutes or so passes. And suddenly the kid walks up through the left side of the theater and his mom is right behind him, holding him from behind. And he looks up at the screen. He just says, no, 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 and turns around and like huddles into her arms. And she turns around and left, and they never came back. And what I'm assuming was the father and the daughter, they stuck around and finished the movie. But yes, we got to witness like a child be traumatized by cats on opening night. That was great. And then, of course, the infamous firmware update. It turns out it just wasn't finished, you guys. We just accidentally released it before it was done. So they said that they had a completed version where the effects had been finished. This was crazy because we'd known for a while that, you know, projection was digital and these were digital files being sent to movie theaters now. That's been the way of the game for a while. This is the first time a movie has said, oh, we can actually update that file to every movie theater remotely from the studio, which was crazy.
That is weird.
And so they released a firmware update for a movie that was currently playing in theaters. And so, of course, I had to go again because I had such an amazing time the first time. And the second time was just as magical and confusing. And it was so funny because there were certain exact moments that I thought, oh, that was pretty unfinished. And so I was keeping an eye out for it. And like, yeah, no, it was still just so bad. And the effects still looked so horrible. Do you know why the effects in Cats look so horrible?
What's the main one?
So Tom Hooper had never worked in motion capture or with heavy CGI effects before. And so all he did was record essentially footage to be used for reference. People weren't actually in like the full dots and like the full outfits. He was recording people wearing like hoodies, and all of these digital artists were complaining vocally that they had been given all of this horrible stuff and that there was nothing they could do with the footage they'd been given. And they didn't do that at first, but they did once the movie came out and all of the actors and all of these other people involved in the production started blaming the visual effects for the failure of the movie. And they felt the need to stand up and defend themselves and say, hey, we all wasted hundreds of hours a week on this stupid movie. And now you're blaming us for something that was not our fault. We did the best we could with what we were given. The director had no vision. We kept getting these different sketches of what the people should look like. We would send him this stuff that was made out of thin air because we had nothing to base it off of. And he would just say no, and he wouldn't tell us how he wanted it fixed or what he wanted fixed. He had no vision at all. And yeah, Tom Hooper hasn't made a film since and hasn't like had a film in pre-production since.
That is a good moment to reference that there's a real crisis going on in the visual effects industry. I don't know what the future holds, but I feel like these workers are being abused and something's got to change.
Yes. Infamously, the effects house Rhythm and Hues that were very famous for creating CGI animals essentially out of nothing. Sometimes they would have green sticks and reference footage and whatnot, but they were very good at just sort of placing a CGI animal into a shot. And they did all of this work on The Life of Pi. It was sort of just as much of a triumph for them as it was for the creators of the film and other aspects of the film. And they created that tiger from the ground up and sort of created the second main performance after the main character. And because of lack of wages, because of lack of funding, just all of these horrible things coming together, the entire effects house went under and everyone lost their jobs in this movie that was nominated for Best Picture and won Best Director. And it won Best Visual Effects. And the people who went up to take the award for it started talking about how Rhythm and Hues was about to go under and that they started talking about the plights of current effects artists. And not only did they play the music to play them out, but they turned off the mic while they were talking because they did not want that to get out into the world.
That's the Oscars.
Made me very emotional.
So are you actually recommending Cats?
I will say this. I'm not recommending it, but you better know what you're getting into when you go into it. Don't go into it expecting like a great movie, but do go into it with, you know, a little talk, a little drinks with your friends. You need at least one friend there who's intimately familiar with the musical itself so that they can complain to you about all of the changes they made to the music, because there's a whole layer of that film's badness that is missed by people who aren't familiar with the original musical.
That's why I'm waiting to watch it.
With me?
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be so much fun.
I feel like that's the way to do it. Yeah, I'm not going to watch it by myself. That's sad.
That is a little sad. You're right. You're right. But yeah, as I said earlier, great year at the movies. Parasite won Best Picture this year. Great movie. Midsommar, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Uncut Gems, Us, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Marriage Story. These are movies that were not only big hits with audiences and with awards goers, but were also just great movies. And it was such a pleasure to get to see all of these in theaters. But there are five films that I think tower a little bit above the rest for me personally. First up, I'm going to recommend The Last Black Man in San Francisco, directed by Joe Talbot.
It's a good one.
This is a film about the gentrification of San Francisco, as well as this film about the culture of people trying to make it in general in a big city. And San Francisco, while playing a huge part in the movie, is not necessary to understanding that experience. It's also, you know, a movie about you trying to support your friend's art and just trying to support your friends in general while still trying to support yourself. There's a lot of struggles and sort of inner chaos on display in this movie. The performances in it are phenomenal. Highly recommend The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Made me cry a little bit.
It's a great one. Yeah.
Yeah. Next up, I'm going to recommend Crawl.
Oh yes.
You like this movie. I was wondering if you did, if you'd seen it, because I knew if you'd seen it, you would liked it.
It's the best alligator horror film.
Yes, Crawl by Alexandre Aja is just a wild ride of a movie. You first think it's going to be a storm horror movie because this girl lives in Florida. She's a professional swimmer. Her uncle is stuck in the basement of his house during a hurricane. And you're like, oh my God, she's going to have to swim through a hurricane. This is crazy. And then she gets to the basement to her uncle, and it turns out the house is infested. And are they alligators or crocodiles?
They're alligators. Alligators are in Florida.
These alligators look great. They have such a good weight to them. The effect of them is so striking. Kaija Scodelario's performance in this is wonderful. It is a silly, campy horror movie, and the stakes are ridiculously high. It's a movie that really sets itself up and then delivers. I think a lot of horror movies have great setups. Not all of them deliver as well as this one does, and I just find this to be such an entertaining movie. I did watch this during the lockdown, during quarantine, and it saved me. It totally, like, dragged me out of a depression. I was having such a good time watching this movie. So, yes, I have to recommend it.
It's great.
Yeah. Next up, I will be recommending Manos, directed by Alejandro Landes.
Oh, I've seen this one too. Yeah.
Oh, that is surprising to me. Not because of you, but because I haven't met a lot of people who have. Did you enjoy this?
Yeah, man, it's the greatest adaptation of
Lord of the Flies.
Lord of the Flies.
And I don't even think that's true. I like Lord of the Flies, the 1940s film, quite a bit.
Oh, I haven't seen it. Yeah, don't listen to me.
This is a take on Lord of the Flies, putting it into a more modern setting. And it's about these eight kids who have a hostage played by Julianne Nicholson and a cow.
You mentioned that they're child soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I didn't. I don't know. They're child soldiers.
Yeah.
And it's about their internal power struggle with each other. And they have these people who are telling them what to do on these speakers and through these walkie-talkies. But at the end of the day, it is about the power dynamics between these children and this hostage's attempts to escape. It's a really great film. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The script is very well written. And even though it's all about these eight very young, inexperienced actors, they all do such a great job. And I found it very entertaining and really well done. Next up, I'm going to recommend First Love by Takashi Miike. Now, Takashi Miike is a very prolific director. He's made quite a few films, and this was his 100th, which was very exciting. And it's a romantic comedy that's also about these two people who are involved in this crazy drug scheme. It's a wild action movie. It's a shootout movie. It's a slim location, you know, one man versus a thousand movie. It's got 20 different movies in it, and all of them are equally entertaining and fun. And I had a great time watching this, and I was happy that a Takashi Miike film got a wider release. I do think it was because of the whole 100th film thing. I think that was one of the main reasons it got wider distribution in the States, but still, it was a pleasure to get to see one in theaters while it was out, and I had a great time with this movie. I was laughing the whole time.
And I didn't see it.
All right, I have two more recommendations, and these were my personal favorite films of 2019, one of which was Pain and Glory by Pedro Almodovar, proving that even in his later age, in the digital era, he still can make a great, beautiful movie. This is a film that's autobiographical in nature, where Antonio Banderas plays Almodovar, and Almodovar is at this film festival, and they're going to be screening one of his older films as sort of a celebration of his career. However, he has personal issues with it because the main actor in that film and he had a huge falling out, and this tells the story of them attempting to rebuild their relationship. It tells a story of addiction and crisis. It tells a story of a lonely gay man, which is a very easy way to get me on your side in a movie in general. Just make it about a lonely gay man, and I'm probably going to give it, you know, a pretty high score.
Make it relatable.
But yes, this is a gorgeous movie. If it were up to me, the Academy would have had some sort of, like, fail-safe, where because Parasite won Best Picture, it couldn't win Best Foreign Language Film, and it would have gone to the runner-up, which I think easily would have been Pain and Glory, and then both of those movies could have gotten a trophy that night, but it's okay. Mm-hmm. It's okay. And then my final recommendation, I mean, you have to know where this is all going. I talked about this movie at length this year. I think I sold you a ticket to go see this movie in theaters.
Yeah, and then after I saw it, I came and talked to you for like 20 minutes about it, because I loved it
so
too.
So cute! Oh, and that is The Lighthouse by Robert Eggers, which was a movie that blew my mind into smithereens. It felt like it was catered to me specifically, and I met a lot of other people who felt the same way. It felt like this sort of Bergman ripoff. Like, it felt like Persona done with men in a lighthouse with more horror elements, and I loved that.
Yeah, what's it about?
The script was wild. It's just about two lighthouse keepers. And one of them is new, and one of them has been there for a while, and they start to go crazy and possibly turn into each other, and there's a mermaid, and there's an octopus. And the script is all authentic dialogue from the late 1800s. It's all written in this sort of older version of English. And so you can't really understand what people are saying throughout most of it, turning it into a very engaging mood piece. But it does have a narrative. And the narrative is wild. It's just a great time at the movies. It hit every mark for me. I saw this four times in theaters. And the fourth time, I'm putting this on the air. I don't care if people know. I don't work there anymore. The fourth time I watched this film, I was working the Tower Theater. And I knew it was the last time it was going to be playing. So I literally was telling people as they were going into the theater, buy your concessions now because the stand will be closed once the movie starts. Didn't give any reasons, didn't need to. It was a Thursday night. No one cared. So everyone did that. I literally closed down and cleaned everything during the trailers and turned off the lights. I had to leave the doors unlocked just in case. You never know who's trying to get out or get in. And yeah, locked up all the other sections. So if anyone did come in, they couldn't get in anywhere, and went in and watched the movie. And that was one of my last shifts at Salt Lake Film Society. Not because of that. They closed because of COVID. But yeah, I have a very fond memory of that, and I loved watching it with that audience who had all managed to catch it the very last time it showed.
Awesome.
Yeah, I love The Lighthouse.
I also love The Lighthouse, and I talk to a lot of people about it, so my opinions are out there in the world.
Oot and a boot. You like any movies this year? Do you like The Irishman?
Kinda.
Do you like Booksmart?
Yeah, I really liked that one. Yeah, that was good. There's a lot of great films. Like you said, 2019 is just an amazing year. I struggle to really find one that I want to highlight that I don't think a lot of people are really fond of already. I'm going to go with more of an obscure choice, and that's Honeyland. Did you see this documentary?
Honeyland? No, I did not. Haven't even heard of it till just now.
Oh my God, I got an obscure one.
He got one. He got one. He got one on me.
This is a great little documentary following the life of this beekeeper. I think it's somewhere in the Middle East. I think she's in Turkey, but she uses old ancient ways of like harvesting honey. And she has a hard and fast rule. Take half of the honey for yourself, but leave half for the hive of bees. And she takes on, and when some new people move in near her little bee farm, she tries to help them and teach them the old ways of harvesting honey, and they don't listen to her. And even though that's like a really simple little story, it encompasses what I think is going on in a mass scale, like worldwide, like people who are trying to exploit as much as they can from the earth versus people who are trying to live in sustainability with the earth and trying to harmonize with the way that nature actually flows. And meanwhile, you have people who are trying to take as much as they can for themselves and make a quick buck. I think it's a lovely little cinema verite documentary, just seeing how this woman works the beehives. And it's so charming. I love Honeyland. You should watch Honeyland if you can.
I'll watch it. It sounds great.
It's on Hulu right now. But yeah, I like that one.
It was like The Farewell. I feel like that one didn't get stated.
Oh, that one was good. Yeah, there's so many good films this year, man.
But you know, I was the hater of Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah, and that's okay.
You sound like you're high.
I've got COVID and it's our last episode. I'm just vibing here.
For sure, for sure.
I was going to mention Jojo Rabbit in relationship to A Hidden Life because I feel like there are some similarities. One is really, really good and one is pretty bad. Nah, I'm just messing with you.
I mean, look, I don't know where this is. I don't know where this is about to go. I guess there's no point in delaying it. Should we talk about A Hidden Life?
Let's get to it, man.
So this year we are discussing A Hidden Life, directed by Terrence Malick, which tells the story of Franz Jägerstätter, who is an Austrian peasant farmer. And him and his wife, Franz, have a very simple and humble life. But unfortunately, the Nazis are coming. And Franz goes off to train in the army. And then it seems like the war will come to an end. I mean, those who have done any history or have listened to our episodes covering it in A Century in Cinema are aware that this war is not quite coming to an end. So Franz, in this moment of levity, thinking that the war is over, is released back to his home. And then suddenly the Nazis come and knock in and say, you got to serve and you've got to dedicate your life to Hitler. And Franz is like, no, I don't think so. That doesn't sound like my kind of vibe. And his wife is like, what are you doing? And his kids are like, what are you doing? And his priest is like, what are you doing? And everyone's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm standing up for what's right. And so he says, I'm not going to do it. And he's in this lineup and all these people are pledging themselves to Hitler and he isn't doing it. So he gets thrown into prison. He gets sentenced with death. And then he dies. He's executed. And his wife sort of becomes the pariah of her village, of their small little village. And yeah.
And that is all based on a true story.
You'd think that movie could be told in about an hour and a half, but this one takes 3 hours.
Yeah, because it's wrestling with faith and God and religion and what is good and what is evil. And there's a lot to talk about in A Hidden Life. It goes on for a while.
What are your general thoughts?
Now, I really love this film.
Okay.
I really like Terrence Malick films, and I think this is one of the best ones out there, honestly. Maybe I have a little recency bias, but at the very least, this is a grand return to form. If you know who Terrence Malick is, if you've seen some of his recent films like Song to Song and Knight of Cups, even Tree of Life, maybe you're thinking he's a little too artsy-fartsy nowadays, and this is him returning to the historical dramas that he used to do, such as The Thin Red Line and Brave Little Toaster.
And The New World.
I was going to say Brave New World, but that wasn't
it. That's not it. I don't know how I figured that out. I literally have no idea how I figured that out.
Two trains of thought away from that one, man.
I want credit for that. There was nothing to go off of.
New World. Yeah, New World. And Days of Heaven. Well, these are the films that Malick got really famous for. And I don't know. It was really cool to see him return to this genre. And I think this is an extraordinary film. I recommended it to my parents, and they watched it, and they really liked it. I warned them that it was a little long, and it is, but they were totally into it. What do you think, Andrew? This is the second time you've seen it.
The first time I saw this, it was in theaters, and I was with a close friend, and I was very enraptured and transported. This time around, this entire weekend has sort of just been insane, and I've been under a lot of stress. And I will be honest, it's completely on me. I was unable to relax and meditate into a state where I could vibe with this movie this time around.
You know, I think that speaks to the kind of film that it is. I think that's interesting.
Yes. So I don't have any negative critiques for A Hidden Life, because I can tell what it's going for and what it does, and what it's going for and what it does is very successful. I think it's results equal its ambition. However, I was just personally unable in this viewing experience to enjoy it in the way it is meant to be enjoyed. I mean, I watched this in three sittings, which is not a good sign. And the thing is that I'd seen it before and I knew what I was getting into. Right. And somehow it felt even slower this time around than the last time. And my brain has just been racing and I've just been under a lot of pressure. So it wasn't the right time, and I can acknowledge that and respect that, and I might regret this being my opinion of the film recorded onto a podcast, but yes, as of now, this one does not stand as tall for me as my favorites of Malick, such as The New World, The Tree of Life, and Badlands, which I think are probably my three favorite Malicks. Those are the ones I continually revisit. And for those wondering, yes, I am talking about the New World extended cut that is over 3 hours long, which I think is the superior version of that film. This just wasn't the right weekend. And we all have weekends like that.
We've said it on this podcast before, like what you bring to a film as you're watching it, that's super important.
Mm-hmm.
And your enjoyment of it depends a lot on like what's going on in your life at the time, what's going on in the world at the time. That's all very, very important. I totally get it. But like I said, I feel like when this came out in 2019, Terrence Malick had been releasing a series of increasingly esoteric films, things that were becoming more and more impenetrable to general audiences. And it seems like the critical reception to A Hidden Life and the audience reception to A Hidden Life was pretty positive. I mean, it's not like this is the most seen film of 2019, but if you look at the ratings online, audience scores are pretty high, especially compared to some of Malick's previous films. Yes. Over the past decade prior.
Yes. I think it's important to mention that Malick had made two films in the 70s, Badlands and Days of Heaven, and then 20 years went by and he did not make another film. And after 20 years, he released The Thin Red Line in 1998. And then again, 7 years later was The New World. And then 6 years later was The Tree of Life. So you're seeing a pattern here, you know, a long time between movies. And then something just sort of snapped in him after The Tree of Life. And he decided that he needed to become prolific. So he released To the Wonder the next year. He released Knights of Cups in 2015. Voyage of Time, which was this sort of like IMAX thing that used footage from The Tree of Life as well as unused footage from The Tree of Life to show like the creation of the universe.
You see that one?
No.
Okay, I did.
And?
I don't like it, man. I don't like almost any of these films.
And then he released Song to Song in 2017. Now, I think it's interesting that Arthur says he doesn't like these movies because I notoriously have not seen any of them.
Oh, really? That is notorious.
I have not seen any of them, and I still consider myself a pretty big Terrence Malick fan. But something about him deciding I am a movie maker now just rubbed me the wrong way. The drive wasn't inside of me to see these movies. Have you seen them all?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. I like Terrence Malick. He's a name that is very famous within the film circles. We got to watch the Terrence Malick films. We got to have opinions on the Terrence Malick films.
Not me. I'm above all that. But I think that that has to do with the critical reception of A Hidden Life, which suddenly felt like a more intentional and direct film from Terrence Malick after these projects that all sort of felt like kind of offshoots of each other and of Tree of Life in a weird way. And A Hidden Life sort of felt like this return to form. And suddenly this was the next great Terrence Malick movie, which is why this is the one I went and saw in theaters.
Why do people like Terrence Malick, Andrew?
Great question. Why do you like Terrence Malick?
Because he makes beautiful films. But seriously.
Yes. He is known for his visual aesthetic specifically.
Even if you find the films a little boring, and my parents admitted that, yeah, A Hidden Life was kind of slow at times, and it is. It's gorgeous. Every shot is beautiful. So well composed. Mm-hmm. So deliberate. Even the trilogy of sort of like iffy films that he made after Tree of Life, you know, To the Wonder, Song to Song, Knight of Cups. These are films that feel a little thrown together in a way. They still look so much better than any other film out there. He has a specific look that he definitely prescribes to, and it has to do with the style and the way that he shoots films. But yeah, it's so unique, so gorgeous. Is that it?
Well, I do think that his visual style is what he's known for. He has sort of this natural movement with the camera that really feels immersive, but at the same time takes a moment to give you these beautiful, splendid views of nature and different points in the earth and in movement. Things that you could be in the same location as Terrence Malick and have the same periphery as him, and he would notice something you didn't. It feels like he's pointing out these moments of beauty and these places of interest that might pass by the normal human eye, but that he has a razor focus for. And in this movie, that's sort of magnified because it is this very tiny town on top of a mountain. And so, yeah, anywhere you look when you're in this town is going to give you this huge cinematic vista. But it's the fact that he found this spot in the first place and decided to tell this story and create this little, like, village up on a mountain.
Yeah, even the locations they find. I mean, not only do they look authentic to the 1940s, but the texture of the walls and the way that the camera moves through the rooms. I mean, it looks powerful. I don't know.
I think you do.
I don't know. It's a feeling that you get from a Terrence Malick film that's unlike anything else. Even the ones that I don't love. Knight of Cups is objectively a mess, but I still love it. I can still watch it and still feel like I'm falling in love with the art of cinema.
Well, we've been discussing the lack of narrative and this sort of dreamy focus and editing style as if it's a negative, but that has also drawn many people in, including myself.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Even his more straightforward films such as Days of Heaven and The New World, which do tell these full stories if you're paying attention, are still told in this very almost meandering style in a way that you feel like you're living in this world and experiencing it on a day-to-day basis, and this story is just sort of incidentally happening around you. It's a very unique way to tell a story, and I do think it draws a lot of people in, myself included.
I was going to say, it's not like there are any scenes that play out in these films. It's just a series of moments that are strung together. And again, we'll talk about the way that these films are put together. It makes sense that it would come out this way, but it reminds me sort of a string of memories that you're having, like you're remembering different moments and things you remember someone saying and a face that someone made. And it's all just kind of jumbled together and it forms a story, quote unquote. When these films work, it forms a story, quote unquote. Like this one is definitely telling a story and it's about characters and everything. So I think this is a great example of Terrence Malick's style working in a way that feels more like a conventional, you know, three act film with a narrative. There is a narrative here.
Yes.
And there's a narrative in The Thin Red Line. That's the World War II film about U.S. forces trying to take an island in the Pacific theater. And then New World is the Pocahontas story. I don't remember what Days of Heaven is about, but I remember it being very pretty.
It's a love triangle that takes place in this small rural farm where these two farmhands fall in love, but she is also the object of desire of the man who owns the entire farm. Mm. And the entire story is told through the narration and observations of a young girl who is also a farmhand and is sort of observing all of this from a distance.
And there you go. And then what is Tree of Life about?
What isn't it about, you know?
It's about the creation of the universe, but also a family who lost a child and the grief that lingers.
My actual answer for what is Tree of Life about, it is about the struggle of nature and grace in the world and how nature is how we got to where we are now. And nature itself is a brutal thing that is unafraid to kill off the weak and continue with the strong. However, grace is something that is sort of an innate human concept that we can share with each other, and we don't have to follow nature's predestined rules for fate to understand each other and to find each other through moments that connect us in ways that we don't expect. And also Sean Penn's there, and that's fun.
It's true. It's all true. So that's his filmography. Terrence Malick got started in the 70s with Badlands. That's the one that feels the least like a Terrence Malick film. You can still kind of feel those. You can still kind of feel the vibe that he's going to settle into later in his career. But that's the one that feels the most traditional. You don't agree?
No, I would agree. I don't think it does not feel like a Terrence Malick film. I think that's where I disagree. I would agree that narratively and story-wise, it's a more traditional film. But there are these elements to it that are sort of the seeds of his style. It's like how I tell people.
Yeah, it's the seeds of his style. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like how I tell people that if they want to get into Tarkovsky, they should watch his films in chronological order. And a lot of people say Ivan's Childhood isn't even a Tarkovsky film because he only directed it halfway through. But I think there's something nice about a movie that's very easy to follow and sort of feels like a, you know, edge of your seat war thriller. And then there are these seeds of his style and what he does and how he makes movies in it. And then you can grow from there. So I don't think Badlands doesn't feel like a Terrence Malick film, unlike something like Ivan's Childhood. It wasn't a production he took over halfway through. It was fully his idea from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. I agree, though, the seeds of his style are there. To me, it feels different from the rest of them. But that's just the evolution of an artist.
Which is what the Tree of Life is all about.
Because it's about everything.
Did you see Tree of Life in theaters?
Yeah, I loved it.
I saw that 4 times in theaters, too. That was a fun time. I remember that it started to get noticeable that people would walk out when the jellyfish came on screen.
Yeah, why the jellyfish? I remember people walking out with the dinosaurs, and I was like, that's the moment where I fell in love with the film. They were like, I thought Brad Pitt was in this.
Yeah.
We're jumping all over the place. We're not giving you any sort of narrative trajectory for Terrence Malick's career and life, but, you know, if that's the way he'd want it,
he is a very private man. We don't know much about him. Have you ever seen that video of TMZ catching Terrence Malick? And I can't remember who the big name actor is next to him, but they stopped the big name actor.
Yeah, it's Benicio del Toro.
Yes. Benicio del Toro is there. And they catch Benicio del Toro and start asking him all these questions. And Terrence Malick just slips away unnoticed. And it's like this very rare video footage of Terrence Malick caught by TMZ. who doesn't even know who he is and don't even do anything about it. It's exactly how he would have wanted it.
Yes, I have seen that because it's the only video footage you can find of Terrence Malick on YouTube, and I was trying to find us some video footage of Terrence Malick for this episode, but it's not out there.
He's like the Thomas Pynchon of film directors. We don't have any pictures of Thomas Pynchon except for this weird picture of him when he was super, super young. And he's just sort of smiling, and like, there's just no way he looks anything like that picture now. He's like that.
He writes it in his contracts when he works on films that you can't use him for any of the film's publicity. He won't do interviews, you know, can't show his face. It's in his contract.
It's because he's a horrible racist and doesn't want people to find out.
We don't know.
No. I'm sorry.
You're right. We don't know.
I just thought that might be a fun one to throw out there. Did you see Together, his VR experience?
Schrodinger is racist. No, I haven't.
There we go. So it's a 6-minute VR experience about the power of human connection. It fuses dance and technology, and it kind of puts you in the middle of an emotional narrative about breaking down barriers and bringing people closer. I haven't experienced it. That's the Letterboxd right up.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I haven't. I haven't done that yet.
His next movie is Avatar 2, The Way of the Wind.
That's not true.
It's just called The Way of the Wind, but the joke writes itself.
It's a Jesus story.
Yeah, it's going to be fighting against Passion of the Christ 2, Electric Boogaloo.
I'm really excited for his Jesus story.
Yeah, same.
I mean, the man's clearly hyper-religious.
Very religious.
Tree of Life is way more about religion than I gave it credit for when I first saw it. I was seeing other things in there, but yeah, on a couple of rewatches, I was like, wait a minute, this is all about God.
God.
And then you watch A Hidden Life and you're like, oh, this is just about God.
Right. Is that my problem? Have I gone too far?
I hope not.
You want me to find my religious roots.
I was hoping you'd have something to say.
I
mean, our main character, his reasoning for not swearing allegiance to Hitler is because he's sworn allegiance to his faith, to his religion, to God. And he sees Hitler as the Antichrist. And this is something that he can't bring his soul, his body to do. He cannot do it. Well, I won't say it's not because of any like earthly reason. I mean, he's horrified by the atrocities going on. And that's part of the reason why he sees Hitler as the Antichrist. But at the end of the day, it's him just saying, like, I'm a man of God. I can't do this, to the point where, you know, his family suffers. I mean, his wife back home while he's in prison is being spat on by the entire village. His children are going to grow up without a father. Like, it's not good for them.
Mm. Reminds me of Noah.
Mm. There are parallels to be made. I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a saint. This is like the forming of a modern saint. And the suffering and the ability to separate one from one's ego for the sake of something grander is a huge part of it.
What makes a person a saint?
No. Why are you asking me this?
Oh, sorry, we don't need to talk about that. I don't care, actually.
They live historically virtuous lives. They offer their life for others, or they're martyred for their faith, and they are worthy of imitation.
Well, he's definitely martyred for his faith, and I think the film is proposing that he is worthy of imitation.
And that he is heroically virtuous.
And yes, he is.
So, tick, 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 all those boxes. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. He seems to just be so steadfast. Yeah, I mean, he has this, the movie sort of almost gives him his religion and his faith as his backup, as his excuse. I mean, his main thing against Hitler is that he sees it as wrong in general. His first turning point is when he is shown war propaganda while he's still in training. And he's seeing what they're doing to other countries, and all the people around him are cheering, and he can't bring himself to do it. So he immediately has this sort of moral contradiction with what his own country is doing and what he's training to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then his religion gets involved because, as you said, because of those things, he then starts to see Hitler as the Antichrist and therefore is like, oh, yeah, it's because of my religion. But I think the initial pull is because he just in general is disgusted by what his own country is doing.
Yeah. So there's a lot of moments where you have him and other characters, people he's talking with, like asking questions like, what do we do as people when our leaders are evil? Like, what can we do? And he goes to the church and the institution of the church and asks like for guidance, for help. And, you know, the church is compromised in Germany and Austria. So when he's talking to the priest, they say, you have a duty to the fatherland. And it's his suspicion that the priest is worried that he's a spy. So, you know, even the church is totally corrupt in the face of this evil force that's taken over the country. And Malick's films always have this really religious overtone, but there's actually not too much to say about the church or about religious institutions. Religion in a Malick film feels very tied to the natural world, and it feels tied to your own personal beliefs. I like that. I like that. I can get behind that, you know. And I don't love religion. I'm an atheist now. So I don't know. Malick's... So the religion that Malick is proposing feels like it's a form of religion that actually speaks to me as an atheist. I see what he's going for, and I still feel like he's talking about something that is true. The beauty of nature and the grace of humanity and, you know, what are we here for, and asking these questions. And whether you ask those questions through prayer or if you ask them just, you know, to yourself as you are wandering through nature, I think that Malick's onto something here.
I agree. There is something absolutely beautiful about this film, and it definitely did speak to me way more my first time watching it than this time. But you seem to have been really moved by it, and I'm moved by that.
Yeah.
Should we finally bring it into like a practical point? The Disney Fox buyout.
How can you relate this to the Disney Fox buyout?
Well, this was originally set to be distributed by 20th Century Fox. In fact, it was the last film to don the logo Fox Searchlight Pictures. It now is just called Searchlight Pictures. They got rid of the Fox. And it was the first of Searchlight Pictures to be distributed by Disney because it was all done like halfway through the year.
Hmm.
And it was not the original plan. And Disney did this very strange thing where they treated it like it was like an Avengers movie, like they treated it like it was a major blockbuster and forced theaters to only be able to play. Like if your theater was playing A Hidden Life, that specific theater could only play A Hidden Life. And you couldn't do like other showings of other movies in that same theater. It had to be A Hidden Life. So if you were going to play A Hidden Life in your theater, it had to be all day. Theaters that only had two theaters in them in the first place running were kind of thrown away from it because it was a 3-hour movie. And so they were unable to really schedule it into their days. And it was just this weird, like sort of underhanded way of making it impossible for theaters to properly show and distribute this movie.
Oh, wow.
It was very strange. But we did have a dedicated Hidden Life theater that played 3 showings a day at the Broadway. And we played it there for... I feel like we played it there for a solid month.
So this is a Disney picture now, huh?
Yeah, this is a Disney movie. One of the many Disney movies we've covered. Right up there with Dumbo and Sound of Music.
It's like the Sound of Music. There's Nazis.
And it also wasn't originally distributed by Disney, but now is.
It's 2019, so it's also worth mentioning that this is the year that the Department of Justice in the U.S., overturns the Paramount decree that was put into place in 1948. So now film studios can own their distribution channels, the theaters.
AMC was not on board.
Theaters were not on board. It's not great for theaters.
It wasn't, but I remember specifically AMC were like the people who were very vocal about it.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
They're very vocal in general as a chain, which is something I appreciate.
And this had been sort of creeping out, phasing out of relevancy because of streaming platforms, which were kind of a way to get around this already. You know, Netflix makes and distributes their own movies and TV shows, right? But this formalization, dissolving the Paramount decree, saying that film studios could now own theaters, Well, we'll see what the future holds.
That we will.
Now Disney can own their own theaters and just only play Disney films. But that's okay because they make all the films.
Mm.
It's not okay.
It's not okay.
But you know what is okay?
What?
The locations and cinematography of Jorg Widmer.
Jorg Widmer. Yeah, he shot this. He shot Pina, one of my recommendations from 2011. I thought he shot another Terrence Malick film, but I guess I'm wrong. Well, he was in camera and electrical department for Tree of Life.
He's shooting Way of the Wind.
It does not say he's shooting Way of the Wind on IMDb.
Oh, really? I thought it said that on Wikipedia. We'll see. We'll see.
That we will. That we will, Arthur.
We'll see what the future holds.
I'm excited for the future.
Terrence Malick films have such a unique look. And you can see it here in Hidden Life. You know, the wandering camera and the lighting, too. You know, there's not a lot of artificial lights. Even the light bulbs in all the houses, you'll notice, are all turned off. And, you know, mainly you're using natural light, soft, indirect sunlight from the windows in order to light everything. And for the past four films, you know, Tree of Life through this weird trilogy he did, he was using Lubezki, this famous director of photography, nicknamed Chivo. I think a lot of general audiences might know Chivo from The Revenant. He shot The Revenant, and it has that same sort of look. But I just assumed that was Lubezki's style. But now that I've seen Hidden Life, you know, and also thinking back on films like Thin Red Line, like, yeah, this is clearly Terrence Malick calling his shots on how his films look.
Yeah, I mean, that was my whole thing with Roma by Alfonso Cuarón. It was his first film not shot by Lubezki, and he shot it. And I was like, oh, so this is Cuarón's deal.
And yeah, you know, the DP here, the cinematographer here,
Jorg Widmer.
Incredible looking shots, but he tricked me. I thought this was Lubezki again, and then I actually looked up. But then once the credits roll, it's not Lubezki, it's Jorg Widmer. But that just means it's Terrence Malick.
Right.
Wow.
It's that Fred, you know, from Scooby-Doo taking off the mask of the villain. And it's just all the different DPs that Terrence Malick has worked with on the mask. And when he takes off the mask, it's just Terrence Malick underneath it.
Oh, it's Terry.
It's good old Terry. So, you know, we brought up the DPs sort of being molded into Malick's style. There actually have been quite a few people who have complained about his style and the way he goes about making films. Specifically, it seems that A New World ruffled quite a few feathers. James Horner, may he rest in peace, also, who was the composer for the score for A New World, also was very frustrated with the post-production process of that film and said that he would never work with Terrence Malick again after making it. And there was this infamous screening where James Horner had composed this piece for a scene and they had played it for this audience of producers, and James Horner says that there was not a dry eye in the audience, and after the sequence was over, Terrence Malick said, "Cut that, I don't want that." And so James Horner ended up writing certain pieces of music, and then Terrence Malick ended up using them in his own way throughout the film. And Horner wasn't a big fan of that, which I can understand. If you're watching a scene and writing music to that scene, and then you see the film and suddenly that music is just in a completely different place that feels like it's done in a way you didn't intend, I can understand that being frustrating.
And also, New World famously had Christopher Plummer in a role. And I had always known, you know, Christopher Plummer was super annoyed and angry with Terrence Malick. But then when I was doing research for this episode, I found this little snippet from a Hollywood Reporter roundtable where he gives his opinion on working with Terrence Malick. And this was the first time I had heard him talk about it. And, you know, I'll link in the show notes. He has quite a bit of respect for Terrence Malick and, you know, says the man creates beautiful images, but yeah, he has to have it his way. And it feels like people who try to collaborate with Malick don't feel respected sometimes. They feel like they're kind of being toyed around with because, yeah, it's a really loose, almost improvisational style. And, you know, there is a script for these films, but everyone kind of tells you in these interviews that, yeah, there's a script, but we threw it out like a couple days in, and now we're just vibing. Now we're just kind of making it up.
Yeah.
There's a guideline, but we'll see how it goes. And for, you know, theatrical actors, people who are used to having scripts, people who are used to having plans, that can be extremely frustrating. And it feels like you're being disrespected. Yeah, I don't blame anyone for being upset or not really liking this style of filmmaking. I'm glad filmmaking in general doesn't work like this, but I'm also glad that there are filmmakers like Terrence Malick who do really unique things like this.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like A New World was just a disaster. It really does. And you can understand why he took 7 more years to make a movie and then his next movie just straight up didn't have a script at all, which was The Tree of Life. The Tree of Life notoriously didn't have a script. It had a scrapbook that was like passed around from person to person with like memorabilia and little things in it and stuff. Jessica Chastain talks about looking at the scrapbook for the first time and laughing, thinking it was like a prank about how Terrence Malick doesn't use a script. And then when she realized it was the actual script, she felt really bad for laughing in his face.
Oh, God. Christopher Plummer also mentions Adrian Brody in Thin Red Line.
Yes.
Adrian Brody thought he was the lead in this World War II 1998 film.
In the script, he was. In the script and what they shot, he was the lead. They fully shot a movie where he's the lead actor.
And then in the editing process, Terrence Malick decided that he was going to edit together a different film with other people that they had shot. And Adrian Brody didn't know, apparently, until like they were doing the press junket. And everyone at this Hollywood Reporter roundtable is just appalled. Like, you get it, right? Like, that is appalling. That's really messed up. Mm-hmm. And OK, Thin Red Line is a great film. But when you watch it and you see Adrian Brody in the shots, you can tell he thinks he's the main character. Mm-hmm. You can tell like he's overacting compared to everyone else. He thinks the camera's focused on him, but the camera's not focused on him. It's actually really sad. I don't know, man.
Yeah, I also think about how Mickey Rourke was in that film and he was cut entirely. He just wasn't in the movie at all. I mean, that happens a lot. Rachel Weisz was also in To the Wonder and was completely cut.
Yeah, I relate the editing process on a Terrence Malick film, and I don't know if I heard this somewhere or if I heard an interview. I don't remember. But it's sort of like you get a bunch of footage, and then you are a sculptor who's finding the actual sculpture underneath this like slab of granite, right? It can be something completely different by the time you're done with it. But you're chiseling away, you're making it into something that it's not. And you hear filmmakers talk about editing that way. You are kind of rewriting the film in post-production. But yeah, Terrence Malick seems to take it to a new extreme. But that makes sense based on the way that he makes films. Like you said, there's no script. Sometimes people just show up to the set and they're given like an index card that just has like the mood of the scene they're doing. And they're just kind of told to make it up, to improv. And the camera rolls and you kind of just roll with it. You inhabit the character, you inhabit the location, and you make it work.
Yeah, they do that in A Hidden Life. In the supplementary YouTube video that you have provided for our audience in the show notes.
There's two.
There is the cast of A Hidden Life talking about how their main acting coaching was them inhabiting these people's lives and living on this farm, and the camera was more of an incidental thing than anything else. And they had no idea what was going to be in the movie.
They say like they were just farming all day. They were just like, they were just plowing the fields and, you know, just like making life work.
Sounds nice. You know, I worked on a farm in Hawaii on the Big Island for just under a week. It wasn't a huge deal or anything, but.
Oh, yeah.
I'm constantly thinking about just selling everything and moving there and just doing that.
I want to be a beekeeper.
I'm so sorry. I tried to swallow that laugh in and it made it loud. I want to be a beekeeper.
It's
no,
like
and
farming.
I have nothing but respect for that. My own
right, it's like farming.
Was supposed to like represent someone else who is also stoned next to you on a couch. Like, all right,
yeah. It'd be nice. Man.
It would be nice.
Do you feel like this film is pretentious?
No.
Okay, because that is something that Christopher Plummer said in that roundtable, that a lot of the dialogue that they're forced to sort of speak doesn't really come out very naturally, and it feels a little pretentious. They're trying really hard to make it sound natural. And I've heard that about Malik.
People love throwing that word around with Malik.
Yeah, I can see where they might be coming from.
I hate that word as a criticism. I don't think it really means anything. I think people just use it. Like, of course, the word itself has meaning, but I think people just use it for movies that are more artistic in nature and are trying to do something grander than your normal Hollywood fare. And when someone feels like they don't understand a movie, or a movie was too slow for them, or they just in general find something frustrating about the artistic use of the film, they just jump to the word pretentious and don't back it up with anything else. And that frustrates me deeply. And I think it's caused the word in modern lexicon to lose its meaning. It is a colloquialism of which I do not prefer.
Okay. Okay.
I'm going off. I'm popping off. Stop me now.
I like these two interviews with the two different sets of actors because, yeah, you have the one group of people, you know, Christopher Plummer's angry that his role got cut down and that he was reading lines that had no meaning for the film and was trying really hard to make it all work. And yeah, it didn't actually matter. And then you also have the cast of A Hidden Life, and they seem really into it. They seem like they really like this way of doing films. It's really unique. There's nothing quite like it. And having a director who lets the actors find a character and live in a world and maybe say something and maybe not if you're not feeling it. I don't know. That's kind of cool when it works. When it works. Because then you have something like Song to Song, and a lot of people didn't really think that one worked.
George Clooney in that interview was like, yeah, I was supposed to be in Thin Red Line. They cut me, and I'm so happy they did. I was like, the fuck? That was pretentious. That was pretentious. I was like, okay, you think you're above the Thin Red Line, George Clooney? Okay.
You just didn't want to be a part of it. I don't know. As an actor, how do you think that you would work with this style of filmmaking?
Oh, I would suffer greatly and I would hate it.
Yeah?
Well, first of all, coming up with things on the fly, I want to say improv, but this is so much deeper than what improv even is as an art form. This is understanding a character and saying things and doing things innately because the character would. That's very difficult for me in general because I find the character through the dialogue that they have. As a theater actor, that's kind of how I've been raised to do character studies. Yeah, you get some background sometimes with a character you're doing. Sometimes you can look up previous performances and read other people's notes on it, things like that. But as far as how I myself am finding the character, it's through the dialogue, I'm saying. So I don't think I would succeed in a Terrence Malick film. He'd cut me pretty quick. Or he'd make me the main character as like some sort of statement against like Jim Caviezel this time.
When you're just wandering around, you're totally lost. He's like, that's my main character.
I'm literally like, where's the crafty bench in the background? He turns it into a movie about making movies because I'm just like wandering around the set. Like, where am I supposed to be?
I'm pretty sure that was Knight of Cups. I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
I should watch it then.
Do you think there's good crafty on Terrence Malick films?
I hope so. They deserve it. They're like living on a mountain and farming.
Yeah.
But is this story for this being Terrence Malick's first narrative film in 15 years, do we think this is a story worth telling? And why do we feel this is a story is worth telling if we do think that?
Yeah, I definitely think this is a story worth telling. It feels really relevant. When we first came up with the list for this project, A Hidden Life was always going to be the one for 2019. It never, ever changed. And, you know, we changed a lot of films on this list. But whenever we looked at 2019, and even though we're not going to get the greatest viewership or listenership with A Hidden Life, you know, it's not Avengers Endgame. It was still a film that I felt spoke to the time period that we're living in right now. And of course, we got to talk about Terrence Malick, the great Terrence Malick. So yeah, I always wanted to talk about this and it feels like it is relevant.
Yes, I will say there is something very honorable about a film showing you the inner emotional turmoil of somebody who decides to do the right thing. And this is something that history has proven was the right thing. So there's sort of a safe bet involved, but also with that safe bet comes this knowledge of, you know, he didn't know this was the right thing to do at the time. Mm-hmm. He was trusting his instinct and what his heart was telling him was right.
You know, this film, as I understand it, began shooting in 2016, came out in 2019. Post-production on a Terrence Malick film takes a little bit of time, I guess. But you can't help but watch this and feel like it's speaking to what's going on in the United States with the rising right-wing movement and the Trump presidency, right? And even if Terrence Malick was only making it in 2016, you know, there's been a movement of right-wing extremism throughout the 2010s. It makes sense for this to come out now. And I think Terrence Malick lives in Austin, Texas now, and, you know, mm-hmm. he's reclusive, so I don't know if that's true. But according to Wikipedia, he's in Austin, Texas. And there's got to be something really disheartening about living amongst, you know, people who call themselves Christians, people who say that they believe in love and they believe in all these things that Christ stood for. And, you know, the Bible teaches us to love each other, and the politics in the United States do not reflect that. If you're a good Christian who like believes in loving your neighbor and watching how people support authoritarians and, you know, just evil people in office, evil politics, that's really disheartening. Mm-hmm. It's not just a thing going on in the United States. Like, this is clearly going on worldwide. I think it's been going on since 2008 with the recession. I mean, people are really scared and they're turning to strong men and supporting politics that make others into enemies and authoritarian tactics. Yeah, they're scared of what the future holds. But we gotta love each other. I kind of knew that's what this film was about, so I definitely wanted to end our project on that note. But also when that quote came up at the end of this film, basically saying that, you know, history is full of people like this. You know, it's full of people who chose to do the right thing, but they are lying in unvisited tombs. They are kind of forgotten to history, but what they did is important. It felt like a great note to end this podcast on.
Yes, I agree. I have nothing to add except for, I'm really happy you enjoyed this movie. I know you've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, in general, I think of films and historical films, you know, as a way to examine things that are hard to examine. I don't know. In my own life, it's easy to watch a movie and sort of go through the emotional turmoil of a character in fiction instead of confronting the actual emotional turmoil of my own life. I think that's why people really gravitate towards certain films.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be helpful. Honestly, that can be sort of like learning lessons through fiction. I mean, is that why we tell stories? So historical movies like this, I think, help us to determine what is going on in our own present and, you know, what sort of future we want to live in. It's helpful to look to the past to try to understand what the hell is going on now. That's kind of what this whole project has been about,
mm-hmm.
in a way.
I will say this. While I didn't much, I don't even want to say I didn't enjoy this recent rewatch, because that's not necessarily true. I did watch it, and I wasn't, like, disappointed or upset by it. It just, you know, as I've already mentioned, it just didn't hit me at the right time. But what this revisit did bring to my attention was the number one most liked review for this film on Letterboxd. Did you read this?
No, I haven't.
So it's very interesting, and it really kind of made the whole viewing worth it to me. It's from this person whose great uncle grew up in the same village as Franz Jagerstatter, the main character of A Hidden Life. And actually, he also resisted the Nazis and Hitler, and he lived kind of a very sad life. It's a review I think is very much worth reading, but he was buried next to Franz Jagerstatter. And this person was at the Toronto International Film Festival screening of this film, unaware of what it was about, and sat there flabbergasted and dumbfounded and glued to the screen as they were watching this person, like a fictional retelling of this person's life who was tangentially connected to them. And I think that even if this film had just reached this one person and this person had been so captivated by this story, that that makes the whole film worth it.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. Yeah, I have to read that. It's pretty long. I can't read it right now, but yes.
Yeah, brain fog. But yes, I really do want to make sure it's clear. I let Arthur sort of take the reins for a lot of this episode. It's not that I did not enjoy this film, because I do. I think this movie is so beautiful. But there are movies that are meant to be watched when you're able to access a more meditative and calm headspace, which I am not in a position to do right now.
Yeah, and you're good, man.
Yeah. And I like the films of Terrence Malick quite a bit. He has his own little stack in my movie collection. Maybe one day I'll go back and watch the ones I missed, but maybe I won't because Arthur hates them. Maybe I'll just steal Arthur's opinion.
No, no, they're objectively pretty not okay, but I love Knight of Cups.
You do like Knight of Cups? Why is that one the one, the outlier?
Dude, I don't know. I love Knight of Cups and I hate Song to Song, and like they're the same movie. I don't get it. I don't know why one works and one just like is not okay. Maybe it's the time that I watched one and the other. I don't know. Maybe I just like Knight of Cups because it's about Hollywood. The entire time I was watching Hidden Life, I was like, where have I seen this guy, August Diehl? And then I was like, oh, he's the Nazi in Inglourious right. Bastards.
Right, he's the one who can tell from Michael Fassbender because he doesn't hold up the right amount of fingers and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So inside each of us is two wolves.
Inside each of us is
one is a Nazi in a Tarantino movie, and one is a Nazi denier resistor in a Terrence Malick film.
That's right. Oh my God. So those are your final thoughts on A Hidden Life. As far as Terrence Malick films go, I think this one is pretty accessible. It's telling a narrative. Some of his films don't tell narratives. But it's also, you know, talking about how Nazis are no good. And
no good.
That's something we can all get
Nazis
behind.
Bad. We're still talking about it all these years later.
We're still talking about it. We were watching films back in the 30s and 40s that we're talking about it, and here we are in 2019.
I feel like we've given final thoughts literally four times each on this movie, so I'm going to force us to move forward.
Well, what did you think of this decade?
And that's what I was about to say was, you know, we have reached the end of our last decade here. Looking back, do we notice any trends?
Well, the trend here is that I had seen a lot of the bigger films out there, and it became harder to include bigger films on our last decade in A Century in Cinema, because part of the rules are that I could not have seen the films. So yeah, we're looking at a lot of independent films, international films, stuff that's a little bit more obscure compared to our previous decades. That's our own trend, though.
For me, I also see the trend of it being independent, lower budget films. I was also going to bring up that as bigger movies are taking over Hollywood, there's sort of this fear that independent films will be forced to become smaller. But we have quite a few very small budget, or at least smaller budget movies that have huge scopes here. I mean, we have Cloud Atlas, we have The Dance of Reality, A Hidden Life, The Handmaiden, even Bone Tomahawk. While I might not care for it too much, it still is a smaller budget film that feels way grander. So it is kind of cool that as movies in general are getting bigger, smaller movies are able to get bigger as well. I mean, I think Cloud Atlas is one of the biggest movies on the entire list as far as its scope and what it sets out to achieve and what it does.
Jumping off of what you just said, I think that we're in an era where film technology and just the way that you make films is way more accessible to everyone. It's just easier to make films now, and I think you can get away with a lot more. You can stretch your budget quite a bit further. Thematically, and you know, maybe this is just the type of film that we picked for this list, but thematically, I also see a trend towards, you know, people dealing with isolation and really trying to figure out how to live in the world. And, you know, A Ghost Story is the most obvious one, but you also have something like Young Adult. Like, how do you navigate the modern world? I feel like a lot of people are suffering mental anxiety these days. And, you know, that's exacerbated after 2020 due to the pandemic. But I think the information age we're living in now you know, post 2010, people are dealing with depression pretty openly, and film starts to reflect that.
I love The Handmaiden.
Yeah.
I feel like that was one of the only episodes that was actually hyped up that I was super excited to record that actually came out in a way that I was satisfied with.
Did a good job. I think you did a great job with Persona.
That's so funny that you knew exactly what I was talking about. Oh, geez.
So that's your favorite film?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to pick. But at the same time, I should just go with my heart, right? And just say The Handmaiden. But I do absolutely love Cloud Atlas, The Dance of Reality. Here's the thing. The Dance of Reality sequel, Endless Poetry. Endless Poetry, Cloud Atlas, The Handmaiden, and Blade Runner 2049. I have gone on record saying those were my four all-time favorite movies from this entire decade. It's like, even though The Dance of Reality isn't technically in that list, it is a precursor to one.
Mm.
And yeah, I love those movies. They mean a lot to me.
Yeah, I think we had an extremely strong decade here. These are all really, really good films with the exception of one.
Yeah, we had one kind of flop that was really fun to, to break apart. Dale, this is me calling you out on the show because I feel like I never do. And you've been such a wonderful listener, and you've been just great and loyal throughout this whole thing. And I really appreciate you as a friend and as a listener and just as everything. Dale, I'm going to put you on the spotlight a little bit, too. She said this. She checked out Bone Tomahawk, saying that she was reluctantly going to rent it after listening to our episode, which she was entertained by. This is Dale's review of Bone Tomahawk. So I checked out Bone Tomahawk from the library yesterday. The guy behind the counter and a man standing next to me in line were both so excited I was going to watch it. They had both loved it. It did have a great cast, but oh my god, what a huge disappointment. I felt like the acting was bad, directing bad, and on and on. I do realize it was made pretty cheap. It seemed ridiculous to me. You mentioned a couple other westerns that I had liked so much better, so the genre isn't totally dead. And then it's a little cowboy smiling emoji.
All right. Well, thanks, Dale. So yeah, we both didn't like Bone Tomahawk, but my favorite film from the decade, again, it's hard, but A Ghost Story was really, really good. And I rewatched that film immediately. Like, it stopped and I just started it again. So yeah, that one was speaking to me in a way that was really personal. I loved that one, but it'd be easy to say that Mandy was also my favorite film. I mean, that's the one I had the most fun with.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think A Hidden Life, I mean, it's so gorgeously composed, and that could be the best film of this decade as well.
Wow.
But then also, it's a certified copy, man. I mean, that was
That was a very low budget mindfuck movie for sure. And Young Adult, I mean, that movie brings me so much pleasure and joy. That's the one I watched the most during the project. I watched that movie three times. That movie really speaks to me a lot. Yeah, I mean, I love every movie here except for Bone Tomahawk. The Dance of Reality is a movie that really speaks to me on a profound and emotional level in a way that I wish A Hidden Life had this time around, because I honestly need a pep talk like that. Maybe I should just revisit Endless Poetry right now, make myself feel better.
Why not? But then our big budget blockbuster of the decade, Noah, was also such a nice surprise. I was expecting to kind of, I don't know, pick apart that film. And yeah, I just really enjoyed it.
I think it's an extremely underrated Darren Aronofsky movie. And even going back to Letterboxd and seeing that 2.6 again, I mean, I just think it's so undeserved.
I'm sorry I haven't mentioned Cloud Atlas, but I know, you know, That one was really, really good, too.
Yes, and it's a movie that you'll need to revisit a little bit later to fully appreciate.
And I'll look forward to it. As far as, like, this decade's place in film history, though, like, it's so hard to say.
Impossible right now. Yeah.
We just got out of this decade. We have the benefit of hindsight for the 90s.
We're still trying desperately to get back to this decade right now. We are wishing we were back in this decade currently right now in history.
Maybe the pre-2016 part of this decade, yeah. Or maybe just for films, just 2019 forever and always, because all the good films came out in 2019. What are we watching next week, Andrew? If you want to know what kind of films we might talk about in our imaginary 2020 episode, you can join our Patreon. We will have our Patreon episodes up there. A huge, huge thank you to our Patreon supporters.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to everybody who has tuned into A Century in Cinema. You have no idea how much it means for us to see the numbers on these downloads and the people who are listening and the people who've reached out to us over the years, and just all of the support we've received for this project has meant so much. And it's been such a pleasure to do these for you. I wouldn't change a single thing about this entire project. Even the episodes I was disappointed in, even the ones that I feel like, you know, we could have done something different, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the day, I'm so proud of this project and what it is and what we achieved. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and review on the podcast streaming service of your choice. It's still very important to us. And also, as we said at the beginning of the episode, this is sort of a project that's meant to exist as it is right now with these episodes. There's one more episode, but with these episodes and as this sort of encapsulation of time from a century in the perspective of two people in the early 2020s. So this is the perfect time to tell people to listen and to recommend it.
They can just listen to whatever episode they want. They can jump around.
Yeah, they can. You can do whatever you want. We didn't have that luxury. We had to do this in order. Now you can listen however you want to, which is awesome. And yeah, really appreciate you all. Our Patreon listeners are going to get a little bonus content as always. And it is going to stay up. What do you have to do? You have to pay for a month to listen to any of it.
Or just keep paying us monthly.
Or just keep paying us monthly. Do what your heart tells you. It's totally worth the what? $9? $6?
$6. Yeah, it's nothing.
$6. I mean, hello. Skip a morning coffee.
Oh, thank you to Nathan Royal for our show's music.
Thank you so much, Nathan Royal.
He's been with us the entire time.
Oh, and I'm going to speak for Arthur. We're so sorry for using the wrong outro music for, I think, like the first 60 episodes. But we did fix it.
It's been super fun talking to you about movies.
Yeah,
Andrew.
Arthur.
Oh. I'm going to give you a virtual hug right now.
Let me. We'll give each other a real big hug later. Don't worry, y'all. We do see each other and we hug every single time. So for the people who are writing fan fiction, you have that to go off of.
It's been very fun to talk to all of y'all out in the real world as well. When I encounter people who have watched films because we've recommended them, or who want to talk about some of the films they grew up with because we are revisiting them on the podcast. I mean, that's just so fun. Mm-hmm. It's been a great pleasure to cross 100 films off of my watch list. All of them brought immense value to my life. Gotta love movies. Gotta love art. It's one of the joys of life.
Yes.
What a great project. Andrew, thank you so much for being there with me the entire time.
From the moment you invited me, I knew I was down for this, and this is something I wanted to do. And yeah, it has really changed my life in a very positive way over the years. And from the moments of me being in weird corners of having to defend movies I love, to the moments of surprise at the movies that you enjoyed that I wasn't sure of, to those really great moments of us both watching a movie for the first time and both loving it. I mean, there was just such a spectrum of reactions and different points that were brought out of me. And I feel like this really helped expand my vocabulary and understanding of film discussion in a way that only a project like this ever could. And it brought a lot of great movies into my life and a lot of really fun revisits as well.
But we will have time to reflect on our past episodes. We're going to do one more episode where we just wrap things up. This is not quite the end, but
it's the last official film we're discussing.
That's right. Andrew, thank you for a magnificent episode.
Yes, to you as well, Arthur.